It is great to be with you. Thank you for that, Justin. Great to be with you. I had to run out to my car just a minute ago and pouring rain. So I think this is the first time I've ever given a talk like this, still dripping wet from the rain outside. So I am glad we're doing this conference for all the reasons that that Justin talked about. I do think it's greatly needed. We know that men and women are both made in the image of God. We have equal worth and value for that reason. We know, too, that men and women are both fallen in Adam. We are totally depraved. Men and women are both sinners. And in Christ, we know that men and women can become co-heirs of salvation. And so the Christian faith opposes both misogyny and misandry. Any degrading of men as men or women as women, the Christian faith is opposed to it. We believe that men and women were designed by God to work together to fulfill God's purposes for the creation, God's purposes for history. There are certain glories that belong to manhood and certain glories that belong to womanhood. And those differences are more than just biological. They're obviously biological, but they're more than biological. Men and women are different, and they are different all the way down. We have different orientations to each other and to the world. We have different functions, different roles to play. And so we must not believe the lie. We must not live by the lie that men and women are interchangeable. That's a lie that our culture is pushing on us. We must resist it. In our day, basic creational and biblical truths about men and women are being denied. Our culture is denying fundamental areas of reality. Fundamental realities, self-evident realities are being denied. And because of this, our culture has fallen into a downward spiral, a kind of tailspin, because these basic truths are being rejected. Our culture has rejected God, and in doing so, we have rejected reality, and we have lost touch with reality. And this is causing untold misery in the culture all around us. The church's calling in the midst of this confusion is to cut through all of this garbage, to cut through all of the lies, and to speak the truth according to God's word about these matters. Men and women are both suffering today. Men and women are alienated from their own natures, and so they're alienated from one another. The polarity that should bind the sexes together and draw them together has been lost, and that's why marriage rates are falling. That's why birth rates are falling to dangerously low levels. We need to recover the Bible's teaching on masculinity and femininity, not only because we want to obey God, that's obviously preeminent, that's the main thing we want to do, but also because the very future of civilization depends upon it. Our civilization will literally die out unless we figure out how to get men and women to pair up, to get married, to form families. This is the primary existential threat in our day. This crisis of sexuality, this misunderstanding about masculinity and femininity. Again, God's purposes require the cooperation of the sexes. This crisis that we're experiencing in our culture over sex and sexuality and sex roles is the crisis of our age. Now, in this conference this weekend, we're really only dealing with half the crisis. It's a crucial aspect of the crisis, but you need to keep in mind it's only half the crisis. There's also the femininity crisis as well. But the masculinity crisis is crucial for us to understand. I'm going to be speaking, obviously, primarily to the men, and in some cases, especially to the young men gathered here this weekend. But again, as Justin said, what I'm talking about here is important for all of us to know and understand. If you are a young man today, it is very, very likely that virtually everything you have been taught about manhood by the world around you, and depending on which church you go to, very likely most of what you've been taught about manhood by the church is false. You have been sold a package of lies. And we can see this because men are obviously not thriving in our culture. Men have had the masculinity beaten out of them. And so I would say to the men, it's time to get it back. It is time for us as men to reclaim what is ours, to reclaim our masculinity. to reclaim our masculine strength and virtue, our calling to be protectors and providers, to be rulers and leaders, to be dominion takers and civilization builders. Men, we are kings. It is time we lived like it. It is glorious to be a man, and we need to grasp that glory. If you're a man, you don't need anyone's permission to be masculine. And you certainly should not be embarrassed by your masculinity, by your God-given masculine instincts. I've got three talks I'm giving this weekend. I want to give you a really quick overview of the three of them, and then we'll really dive into the first one. This is all just by way of introduction. First tonight, this first talk, the masculinity crisis. We're going to look at what men are up against, what forces are arrayed against men and against true masculinity today. Again, men have been propagandized. There is a massive psyop going on to make us think that masculinity is toxic. That's the problem we're trying to solve, but we need to identify that problem. Then later tonight, we'll talk about the masculine virtues. What does it mean to be a good man who is good at being a man? What is manhood supposed to look like? What is God's design for men? What is the core of masculine strength? What does masculine energy look like in action? What should men pursue and what should they reject? And then finally in the morning, we'll talk about the masculine patriarch. The archetype of masculinity, of course, is found within the Trinity. We talk about the fatherhood of God or the sonship of God the Son. Men are made to lead families as husbands and then as fathers. And this leadership in the home spills over into other areas of life, obviously the church and then in society. What does it look like? What does it mean to be a masculine ruler, a masculine patriarch? The meaning of the word patriarch is father rule. What does it mean to be a father who rules? We'll talk about that tomorrow, what it means for a man to be the head of his household and how that spills over into the rest of life. So let's get into this. Let's talk about the masculinity crisis. Our culture seems to have an almost pathological hatred of men and masculinity. So much so that there are many men out there today who are filled with self-loathing. They hate their own masculinity. They're embarrassed by their own manhood. The culture's attack on masculinity begins with boys, and then it continues into older age, into adulthood. Men, you need to understand, the culture wants to castrate you. The culture wants to emasculate you. The culture wants to feminize you. The culture wants androgyny, that is a sexless or a unisex society. The one thing the culture does not want is real, virile, lively, energetic, godly masculinity. The red-blooded Christian male is an endangered species in our day. We need to bring him back. The war on masculinity has been waged for a long time now, and it's been very successful. Men are in crisis in our culture. Men lack good role models. They lack good models of masculinity. Anything that is perceived as the least bit masculine today is seen as a threat. Younger men today have, on average, lower testosterone levels than past generations. Men suffer more deaths of despair than women. Men are far more likely to commit suicide. Men are much more likely to suffer from loneliness. Public schools are very hostile to boys and often treat boys as if they were defective girls. In fact, they will try to medicate the boyishness out of boys. If a young boy in a public school shows too much spirit, too much of that young masculinity, he's going to get drugged until it's drugged out of him. In recent years, we've seen boys in schools get punished for doing typically boy-like things. One boy got in trouble because he chewed his Pop-Tart into the shape of a gun. Okay, can you imagine the horrors of that? In another case, a teacher called in a boy's parents because he drew a picture of a battle and some of the figures that he drew had been beheaded. Okay, I mean, no telling what they would have done with, you know, with me and my childhood and the things I drew. There's nothing unusual about that for a boy. That's perfectly normal behavior for a boy. But if a teacher, of course, a female teacher, disapproves of it and then punishes him for it, what is going to happen to that boy? Is he going to be enthusiastic about going to school and learning? Is he going to think that in order to succeed in this environment, he's got to suppress his masculine instincts? Whatever the case, he's not going to thrive as a boy in that environment. I think the school started going downhill when they outlawed dodgeball. Okay, actually, they were going downhill long before that, but that was like, I think, a real crisis moment when they outlawed dodgeball. OK, Schools have been feminized. They're highly feminized environment. And that is certainly true of the public schools. But I have to tell you, it is true of many Christian schools as well. They are hostile to any expression of masculinity. They are highly feminized environments. In fact, girls are privileged and favored in all kinds of ways. Girls are given more opportunities and encouragement in school. They've got more scholarship opportunities. So not surprisingly, more girls are in college now than boys. Men are constantly depicted in negative ways in pop culture, in movies, in TV shows, in commercials. Almost every man that shows up in a commercial now is extremely effeminate. You might think that they're just all gay. It kind of feels like the whole world has gone gay, actually, when you look at it. Because when men are presented to us, they are very effeminate. Men, especially fathers, are made to look stupid. There has been a concerted effort to destroy or outlaw things that men are interested in or things that men like, whether it's red meat or football or guns or cars. The progressives want to take all those things away from us. All the things that men like, progressives are seeking to outlaw. A few years back, the American Psychological Association declared traditional masculinity to be pathological. That is to say, they declared masculinity to be a disease. And they said, we can cure this disease. They called for a new psychology of men that would effectively feminize men. So you would produce a new, more sensitive, less aggressive, less competitive kind of man. That's the goal. Men are discriminated in various kinds of ways. If a man and a woman commit the same crime, on average, the man's going to get a tougher sentence. Family courts in many states are notorious for treating men terribly when it comes to divorce settlements and child custody. If you go to family court, one of the family courts in New York City, I've got a picture of this, but it's too small for you to see. But they've got a statue of Medusa, so a woman, a statue of Medusa right outside the family court. And she is holding the head of Perseus. So she's beheaded Perseus and she is holding his head. So men walking into the family court, okay, about to try to, you know, settle custody disputes and talk about alimony and these kinds of things. Right outside, they see a woman holding the severed head of a man. How do you think that makes men feel? That's a sign, in many cases, of what is coming, what is awaiting them inside the court. If women excel in some field, that's considered a sign of progress. Nobody cares that men might be left behind in this particular field. But if women lag behind in any given field, that is a sign that we still have a long ways to go to overcome oppression and misogyny. It's like there's a double standard at work. You might remember the James Damore story from a few years back. He was an engineer at Google, very talented engineer, and the issue came up in an internal discussion at Google. Why aren't we having more women in engineering? Google wanted to hire more women. Why aren't there more women in going into STEM? More women in computer engineering and programming and so forth. The feminist narrative says the reason that women don't go into STEM fields like engineering and computer science and so forth is because men oppress them and men make those fields inhospitable. So it's really about the misogyny. Google was pushing to make an equal number of hires of female engineers as to male engineers. And in this internal discussion within Google, Damore had the audacity to suggest that the reason women do not go into STEM as often as men is not due to misogyny, it's actually due to nature. Women are just not as interested in these things by nature. By nature, men are more interested in things. Women are more interested in people. And so Damore argued that the lack of equal representation of women in this field of computer engineering is not really a problem. It doesn't necessarily indicate we're doing something wrong. And in fact, if a company like Google were to try to hire as many female engineers as male engineers, they would end up discriminating against men because they'd have to pass over a lot of more qualified men in order to hire the same number of women as men. This is what we've seen in other fields, like the Secret Service, for example. Okay, those female Secret Service agents that did such a terrible job trying to protect Trump, they were hired even though they were less qualified than men who could have filled those positions. So men were passed over so this women could be hired basically to fill a quota. More qualified men passed over just so a woman can be hired because she is a woman. So Damore made this claim, going back to his story, what happened at Google. Basically, Damore made the point that men are more naturally interested in things like engineering and science and computers, while women are more interested and more inclined to things like nursing and teaching, where they're going to interact with people a whole lot more. Well, of course, Damore had all the data on his side, but he was fired anyway. And he was fired for being a bigot. He was accused of advancing incorrect views of gender. The female diversity officer at Google just couldn't take it, and so she canned him. Even though, again, the data was all on his side. Another issue, another aspect of this crisis, the loss of male spaces. Men need male-only spaces. Boys need male-only environments in which they can learn masculinity. Masculinity can really only be learned in a male-only space. But we have lost almost all of our male-only spaces. Think about the Boy Scouts. That was once a male-only space, and for a long time it was a really good one that taught men a lot of good skills. The Boy Scouts, of course, they don't even exist. Now they're just the Scouts, and it's been completely ruined. It's certainly not a male-only space anymore. Think about seminary. Seminaries used to be male-only spaces devoted to training men in a manly way to be pastors, because pastoring was understood to be a masculine task. But now many, even conservative seminaries, are over half women. Most of the women there to get things like counseling degrees and whatnot, but still, their presence in the classroom changes the dynamic. It changes the culture of the seminary. It changes the way error is addressed. It changes the way people in the classroom have their theology corrected. The presence of women changes the whole dynamic. Or think about the military. This used to be a male-only space, but not now. In fact, the Army is missing its recruiting goals, its recruitment goals for males by a wide, wide margin, because political correctness has taken over and it's driven men away. It's no longer a male-only space. Many workplaces that used to be exclusively male or primarily male spaces are now mixed spaces. And of course, now you have HR departments that have been tasked with policing male-female interactions in the workplace, and it's usually a very a woman-dominated HR department, and that makes it even more difficult for men in those environments. Men need male-only spaces because that's where male bonding takes place. Those male friendships that are so important, that's where they're often formed. Every man needs a band of brothers. Every man needs a godly gang of other men who can sharpen and strengthen him and challenge him. And if you pay close attention, you'll notice this. Men behave differently, even towards one another, in the presence of women. Men can't form friendships in the same kind of way when women are present. Bring a woman into an all-male workforce or an all-male club or some other all-male space, and suddenly men will generally have to begin relating on women's terms rather than their own. It's just a fact. It's a fact of nature. Male-only spaces operate according to male norms, just like female-only spaces operate according to feminine norms. When men are with one another, they tend to speak very directly to one another. They're comfortable with hierarchy. They're willing to debate. Feelings are always going to be subordinated to ideas. Feelings are going to be subordinated to the mission. Men do not mind conflict. Men do not mind disagreement. Men do not mind there being winners and losers. They don't mind competition. In fact, they often thrive on that. Now throw a woman or several women into the mix, and all of that changes. Now there has to be great sensitivity to feelings. The men suddenly feel like they're walking on eggshells. The leadership is now more about consensus building rather than hierarchy. And it's about conflict avoidance, and subtle indirect forms of communication become necessary. In fact, they become the norm. Empathizing becomes more important than ideas or mission. And of course, once women are involved, everybody has to get a trophy. That's just the way it is. Now, it's not bad that women feel that way. In those spheres where women are supposed to operate, those are all good things. But in places where men are supposed to operate, they're a problem. Male-only spaces simply have a different culture than a mixed-sex space or a female-only space. If all male-only spaces are taken away, there are fewer places left for boys to learn manhood. And that's what we're seeing
happen. It also means there are fewer places for men to form friendships, which means more male loneliness, which is again what we're seeing. When workplaces were mainly male spaces because there was a kind of division of labor, women working more in the domestic sphere, men more in the public sphere, those male, primarily male workspaces were not only useful for men who wanted to be able to bring home a paycheck and provide for their family, they were also useful as places where men could build camaraderie and learn masculinity from other men. Sports is perhaps one area left where you can have a male-only space. Men generally can have their own sports teams. Of course, with transgenderism, all of this is being thrown into chaos, certainly for the women. But it does seem very often men can have their own sports teams, so that's good. But note this, even in the SEC, they're trying to sneak women onto the football team as kickers. Why do you think they're trying to do that? They let female reporters in onto the sideline. In the NFL, they even let female reporters into the locker rooms. If you want to talk about what should be a male-only space, that certainly should be one. And now they let women be announcers for football games. If I turn on a football game and I hear a woman's voice as a commentator, I just turn it off right away or I mute her. And if you think that's wrong or sexist, you're the one who's wrong. Because that's just not right. It's not right. That's not the way it should be. I don't mind women being football fans. That's fine. But I don't want to have to listen to them talk about it. Another issue. Boys have their development stunted by porn and by video games. Now, I'm not saying that those are morally equivalent here, even though I'm lumping them together. Obviously, pornography is uniformly wicked, and it is emasculating. Video games in moderation might be okay. But here's the problem, and here's my point. Young men are amusing themselves to death with fake sex and fake war. And this is why a lot of young men fail to launch. They lack ambition, they lack drive, because they have numbed themselves with highly addictive and in some cases highly destructive forms of entertainment. The virtual world has replaced the real world for a lot of young men. And this too is part of the masculinity crisis. Also note this, many times in the media, men's problems get recast as problems for women. Or to put it another way, the only reason that men's issues register, the only reason that men's problems register at all is because they create a problem for women. Men's issues only register insofar as they have a negative impact on women. Let me give you some headlines here. These are headlines, and I want you to know these headlines were taken from mainstream publications, not women's magazines or something, you know, something just for women. These are mainstream publications, and note how female-centric, how gynocentric these headlines are. Broke men are making it hard for women to marry. Okay. The problem is not that men lack, say, job opportunities. The problem is that a woman may not get to marry a man who earns enough money to facilitate her dreams. The whole problem is looked at only from the woman's perspective. Here's another headline. Women are struggling to find men who make as much money as they do. They want to find a husband who makes at least as much money as they do. That's a natural desire for a woman to look to a man to be her provider. My guess is a lot of these women who are complaining about the fact that they can't find a man who makes as much or more money than they do are the same ones who at other times have complained about the wage gap. figure that out. That's not very logical. That kind of thing is happening. Here's another headline I came across. Men have no friends and women bear the burden. Okay, no one seems to care why men don't have friends today, why men don't have spaces where they can bond with other men. This problem only matters and only registers as a problem insofar as it negatively impacts women. In this way of thinking that's so common in our culture, women are always victims and men are always the problem. And men's issues only register insofar as they create issues for women. We hear a lot about women wanting equal opportunities in all fields and all professions. But most of the difficult, dangerous work is still done by men. Feminists will talk a lot about the need for equal pay. And actually, if anybody tells you there is a wage gap between men and women, the whole thing is just a lie. It's just a farce. If you actually compare apples to apples and not apples to oranges, you find men and women really do get paid the same. And if that wasn't the case, of course, all the company would have to do is hire all women, and they could charge lower prices and make a higher profit and drive all their competitors out of business. But it just that's not reality. That's simply not true to the way things actually are. But think about this. For all our talk about equality in the culture today, most of the difficult and dangerous work is still done by men. What percentage of work-related deaths do you think happen to men compared to women? 94% of work-related deaths happen to men. You don't hear feminists talk about wanting to equalize that statistic. Okay, well, they want to equalize everything else, but for some reason this gets overlooked. Nobody's saying we need more female deaths in the workplace to equalize things. A huge aspect of the masculinity crisis is related to this. A huge aspect of this is that men's contributions are invisible and underappreciated. Men are no longer honored for what they do. Men used to be honored for the work, the services that they render. That is no longer the case. So you'll hear the young feminist woman today brag about how she doesn't need a man. She's a strong, independent woman. She's a girl boss. All she's really doing is revealing how ignorant she is of the way the world works. The men who make her life so comfortable are invisible to her. The men who design, build, and repair the infrastructure, who build the cars and trucks and airplanes and skyscrapers and so on, the men who get the raw materials out of the ground like iron and oil, the men who maintain the electrical grid and other utilities, the men who take care of the plumbing. You know, it's 98% men who do most of these professions, who do this difficult, dangerous work that makes all of our lives so comfortable. Those men are invisible to the typical feminist woman. Contrary to feminism's claims, women most certainly need men and depend on men and ought to appreciate men and honor men for their contributions. Listen to Camille Paglia. She is not a Christian. I don't know what she is. She's a very strange person. But listen to what she says. She has some insight here. She says, we could make an epic catalog of male achievements. From paved roads, indoor plumbing, and washing machines to eyeglasses, antibiotics, and disposable diapers. We enjoy fresh, safe milk and meat and vegetables and tropical fruits heaped in snowbound cities. When I cross the George Washington Bridge or any of America's great bridges, I think men have done this. Construction is a sublime male poetry. When I see a giant crane passing on a flatbed truck, I pause in awe and reverence as one would for a church procession. What power of conception, what grandiosity. These cranes tie us to ancient Egypt, where monumental architecture was first imagined and achieved. If civilization had been left in female hands, we would still be living in grass huts. Listen to Lori Alexander. She is a Christian and an anti-feminist, but listen to what she says. There sure are a lot of angry women out there who don't want to acknowledge and appreciate all that men have accomplished. Most women today falsely believe that it is the feminist movement that has made their lives so much better, but that's not true at all. It is men who have made their lives better. In every era, it has been male invention that provided women with the means to an easier life. She says, if a woman wants a steak, she drives to the store in her car that men have invented and built, goes into the store that men have built with the money she has earned, and buys a steak. The steak was from a cow on a farm that most likely a man had run. Then a man slaughtered that cow and cut it up to ready it to be sold. Then a man drove the semi-truck to the store. Then she goes home and flips on a switch to turn the lights and air conditioning on. All these things were invented and built by men. This is the same for almost everything else that she will use. Our homes were built by men. The factories where our clothing is made were built by men. And so are the machines that made the clothing. Men have made it so good for women that women think they don't need men any longer. Yes, women have invented a few things, but they are minuscule in comparison to what men have invented and built. Feminists don't want to admit this. Many of them truly seem to despise men. They made the term patriarch to be a horrible word, as if men as leaders of families and nations was a horrible thing. They think they can do better than men. Young women, feminism has sold you a load of lies. He, that is God, has made us, speaking to women here, has made us the weaker vessel, so we would need and want a man. In past generations, women and children wouldn't have been able to survive without men. And if something were to happen to all of the men today, we wouldn't survive for long either. They still do all of the heavy lifting that keeps culture running smoothly. And I think that is exactly right. Again, you probably can't see this, but this is a picture of Los Angeles in 1901. And then another picture of Los Angeles in 2002. And the 1901 picture, there's virtually nothing there. Just a few small structures, otherwise it's just hills. And then 2002, of course, it's got roads, it's got highways, it's got skyscrapers and all kinds of other buildings. You ask yourself the question, what's the difference between Los Angeles 1901 and Los Angeles 2002 in terms of these pictures? What made the difference between the top and bottom picture here? Masculine energy, masculine ingenuity, masculine dominion, masculine labor. That's what made the difference. That's what built our civilization. Today, men have been demoralized by a society that does not appreciate them. The culture does not honor men for their contributions. Nevertheless, men continue to be the builders and maintainers of our civilization. I would say men ought to be thanked for that. You can think of it this way in terms of the differences between men and women. I talked about a division of labor between men and women. I'll talk about this a little bit more as we go. But think of it this way. Men build a world outside of themselves primarily. Women build a world inside of themselves primarily. Okay? Men build civilization. Women make babies. And that's the way to think about it. That's the division of labor that God has built into the human race. Here is another way of thinking about an issue that men today face. I've kind of alluded to this already, but because of various initiatives, DEI initiatives and so forth, men are often discriminated against in job hires. Less qualified women often get hired because of these quotas. Corporations are often incentivized to hire and promote women over men. Sometimes this is driven by the government. I know people that have started businesses and they've gone out and looked for a woman to be a co-starter, even though she might have known very little to nothing about the business, because they got all kinds of government funding and grants if they had a woman involved. Okay. And sometimes it comes from within the corporation itself, where, for example, CEOs will be more heavily, they'll be paid more, they'll be more heavily compensated if they make these various DEI hires, which often consist of women. Jobs are often advertised in such a way that men are told they need not apply. And this has a cascade effect. When men don't get good jobs, it's harder to get married, harder to start a family, harder to be the provider the way any good man would want to be. It's crippling when the jobs aren't there, or when the jobs that could have been and should have been yours are given to others. And many men simply give up and drop out of the workforce. Again, you probably can't see this, but there's a graph here that basically shows a declining curve there. It's the number of men in the workforce, and it's just declining. More and more men dropping out because of this. They just don't know what else to do. Men have become the scapegoats of society. Men are consistently blamed in the media for just about every social ill, whether you're talking about the low marriage rates and low birth rates. Even climate change is blamed on men. The patriarchy gets blamed for climate change. There was an article a while back that was entitled, quote, "A Man-Made Crisis, Toxic Masculinity Drives Climate Change." The benefits of what men have brought into the world, their inventions, their discoveries, the other contributions men have made, they're ignored. Instead, men are blamed for everything that has gone wrong. Even if it's an imaginary problem like climate change, they're going to blame men for it. Obviously, men are sinners. Obviously, men do terrible things. But this is a kind of bias. This is a kind of misandry that is destructive to our society. There are toxic men. Nobody denies that. There are evil men, abusive men. Men and women are both sinners. But something more is going on here. We're not talking about just dealing with run-of-the-mill sin. We're talking about a bias against men in our culture. There are men who, yes, certainly mistreat and hurt and abuse women. The reality is there are also women who make all kinds of false accusations against men. Think about the Me Too movement. Certainly, some of that was necessary, men who had gotten away with horrific behavior, but it also became really obvious there were a lot of false accusations being thrown around, and women could do that. They could make false accusations because they knew with a high degree of probability that they would be believed. Even if there's a lack of evidence, the woman would still be believed because there's this bias against men in our culture. And I've already mentioned this, but I want to highlight it again. Fathers bear the brunt of the attack on masculinity in our culture. Fathers have been targeted. They've been targeted by the feminists. They've been targeted by the Marxist. And the breakdown of fatherhood, the problem of fatherlessness, is the single greatest catastrophe our society has faced over the last several generations, certainly over the last 60 years. Herbert Marcuse, the Marxist, who was so influential, he said that in order for the goals of communism to succeed, he said the meaning of the word father had to change. He said the meaning of the word father had to change from a largely positive association, a largely positive word associated with things like authority and wisdom and protection. It had to become a largely negative word associated with things like cruelty, domination, and exploitation. Okay, feminists have said the exact same thing, because Marxism basically applies the oppressed categories to socioeconomics. The rich are always oppressing the poor. Feminism does it, but it does it with the genders. So men are always oppressing women. So, of course, feminists see husbands and fathers as intrinsically oppressive. They've put all these negative associations, or associated all these negative things with fatherhood. The attack on fatherhood has been incredibly effective. And when fatherhood fails, the family fails, and the breakdown of the family and the rise of fatherlessness is the most horrific social development over the last several generations. Fatherlessness is at the heart of the masculinity crisis in our nation. It's really at the heart of the crisis that our whole culture is enduring. Our social order is in danger of collapsing because of fatherlessness, because of this attack on fathers. I could go on and on here, but you get the picture. Men are up against a lot. Now, none of this is to say that it's somehow easy to be a woman today. Women face their own set of challenges. As I said, there's a femininity crisis that really, in a lot of ways, is the mirror image of the masculinity crisis. Biblical creational femininity is not exactly supported by our culture either. Our culture has attacked fatherhood. Our culture really has also attacked motherhood as well. This is what we've got to understand. In our culture, it's not just that we have the battle of the sexes. You know, it's not just that we have this battle between the sexes. It's not just that we have a war on this war of the sexes, this war between the sexes. We have a war on sex itself, on the reality of sex, on the reality of maleness and femaleness, masculinity and femininity. Masculinity is being distorted and suppressed in our society. Femininity is being suppressed and distorted in our society as well. Our society loves gender bending. Our society promotes gender confusion at every turn. You're seeing it in the Olympics with female boxing and female rugby and men beating up on women. You know, the Babylon Bee had a headline about, you know, domestic violence now an Olympic sport. I mean, we can poke fun at it, but this is a serious, serious crisis. And our culture is promoting this confusion at every turn. You see it in Hollywood, where they've got the tiny little petite woman who beats up all these big strong men. And it's obviously fantasy. It could never happen in reality. But they want you to think that men and women are so interchangeable and the differences between them so minimized and so negligible that that kind of thing, that we can think in those kinds of categories. Our culture is waging an all-out war on God's design for sex and sexuality and the sexes, and this is making people all around us miserable and confused. And that means we have a wonderful evangelistic opportunity in front of us, a wonderful discipleship opportunity in front of us. To really understand all of this, you have to understand something about the feminist movement. I want to talk about feminism here for just a minute as I begin to wrap this up. Almost all of these problems are downstream from feminism. And I know people like to talk about different waves of feminism and whatnot, but I'll just tell you, all the different waves are all bad. Okay, it gets worse, okay, but it starts off bad and it gets worse from there. What we are seeing around us is a consequence of feminism. Now, you can say feminism was a great test that the men of the West were put to and that they failed. I think that's true. So you can say that feminism arose because men failed in various ways. That's true. Okay. But feminism has impacted men and women. It's pervasive in our society, and it's a way of identifying and sort of trying to get our hands on this problem we face. Feminism has always sought to minimize the differences between men and women. Feminism has always aimed at a kind of androgyny. In other words, you could say feminism really was the original transgender movement because it aimed to make men and women interchangeable. That's really what transgenderism is all about. I've been saying for years that we need to call the LGBTQ movement the F-LGBTQ movement. Because we need to add feminism to that set of letters there. Because all of those other sexual perversions, the LGBT and Q, they all flow out of the F, out of feminism. So put an F for feminism in front of LGBTQ to make that point. Feminism went hand in hand with the sexual revolution, of course. It's, again, really just two ways of getting at the same thing. And the sexual revolution separated sex from marriage and from procreation. The goal of feminism and of the sexual revolution has been sexual autonomy. That is, sex without consequences. So you have androgyny when it comes to how men and women relate, and then you have sex without consequences when it comes to the act of sex itself. This, for example, is why abortion is so crucial to feminism. Why have Democrats gone all in on abortion and now even Republicans have caved on this issue? It's because feminism has infiltrated everything. Abortion is necessary to the feminist view of equality and freedom. That's why they talk about things like reproductive justice, or they use those buzzwords like equality and freedom and so forth. In the feminist view, without abortion, women can never be equal to men because bearing children would penalize them. Bearing children could interfere with a woman's career prospects and could put her at a disadvantage compared to men. So, in order to have equality, you got to have abortion. And it's also necessary to their version of freedom because in the progressive way of looking at things, freedom means no responsibility. It is freedom from responsibility. Any kind of responsibility is seen as confining. So I should not have to deal with any of the consequences of my actions. So abortion is a way to make sex a consequenceless act, supposedly. So you got to be free to have sex without consequence and without responsibility. And so what's happened in our culture is we have broken apart what God has joined together. God joined together these things. God linked together sex, marriage, and children. He designed for all of them to be a kind of package deal. And we've broken them apart so we can have the sex without the other things. Again, feminism has infected men, women, and most of our society, most of the institutions of our society, even most of our churches, most of our denominations have been infected with feminism. If we're going to solve this masculinity crisis, we have to fight back against feminism. Feminism must be overcome and eliminated. That means we have to unwind all the consequences of the sexual revolution. Let me just give you one example of this to drive this home for the men. If you are a man who fornicates, you are a feminist. You are effeminate. You are part of the problem. If you are a man who fornicates, then you are really, you might think you're so macho and you get all these women into bed with you, but you are actually effeminate. You are actually a feminist. You're not living as a truly masculine man, because a truly masculine man would never separate his actions from their consequences or his actions from taking responsibility for those actions. Pete Buttigieg, okay, obviously we don't think too highly of him. He's a big problem. But he inadvertently got at this, or maybe it was purposely, I don't know. But he got at this the other day when he was talking about abortion and, of course, promoting abortion. And he said that not just women, but also men are freer when abortion is legal. What did he mean by that? How does abortion free men? You constantly see this association with abortion and freedom. What does he mean when he says abortion makes men more free? Free to be what? Free to be irresponsible? Free to take what isn't theirs without consequence? Free to sacrifice a child on the altar of their own selfish sexual pleasure? Free to kill the baby they've created rather than take responsibility for that baby and raise that baby? We can't accept the world's use of these terms like freedom and equality and justice. This is where we're being propagandized. This is where the PSYOP is taking place. We've got to push back against these things. Let me wrap this up. A few more thoughts here. I have described what men today face. Men, you got to be careful how you process this, because if you just think about all those things I said that you're up against, it's easy, especially for young men, to start to think of themselves as victims. If you're a young man, it is true, you do face challenges. You face some very difficult challenges that you've got to navigate. But I would tell you this, they're no greater than challenges faced by men in other generations. They might be different challenges, different set of challenges, but they're not greater. And so I would tell you, if you're a young man thinking about all this, how am I going to make it in this kind of world that is so full of hatred towards men? Don't catastrophize. Instead, recognize that the challenges are an opportunity for you to grow in strength as you rise up to meet and overcome these challenges. We're going to work to change these things that are arrayed against all men, and especially young men in today's world. But in the meantime, you can't give up, and you can't just think of yourself as a victim. You got to understand, if these are the dragons God wants you to slay, then get after it. Go do the dragon slaying. Control the controllables and leave the rest to God. Obey God's word and work hard, and then let the chips fall where they may. Yes, the world is hard today for young men to navigate, no doubt. But I would tell you, go create a future for yourself you can be excited about. You don't really want an easy life anyway. That's not going to make much of a man out of you if life's too easy. You want some challenges, so you've got them. The glory of manhood is found in facing adversity and rising above it. Yes, you do live in a feminized, feminist, gynocentric world. So what? Put your head down, get to work, make the best of your situation. And as you do so, do not let even a hint of misogyny arise in your heart. Where you think, oh, you know, it's the women's fault. So often, that's what young men want to do. Look at this. All these societal forces are arrayed against me, and they start to, you know, they just as men have been turned into a scapegoat, so men want to turn the women into the scapegoat and blame all their problems on women. You cannot do that. You have to remember, according to God's design, men and women will stand or fall together. You cannot fix men without fixing women, and vice versa. Men cannot win without women winning as well. And if the men lose, the women will also lose. That's just how it is. G.K. Chesterton saw this in his day, and this is how he described it. He said, "We men and women are all in the same boat upon a stormy sea. We owe to each other a terrible and tragic loyalty. We will make it or we will sink. You know, we'll make it to our destination or we will drown together." That's it. Men and women are in it together. What is the answer to this masculinity crisis? Well, in my next couple of talks, I want to sketch out an answer to that question, but I want to leave you with a few thoughts here. The masculinity crisis can only be solved through the gospel, as men have their sins forgiven and their consciences cleansed, and as they begin to be conformed to the image of Christ. Grace restores nature. That means becoming a Christian makes you more of a man, not less of a man. Grace makes you more fully masculine, not less masculine. Now, so you might think, well, I've seen a lot of guys in the church that didn't seem too masculine. What's going on there? I'll talk about that. We're going to get to that. Also, know this. If you're a young man, you need to develop a plan for life. You need to sketch out what you want your life story to look at. The vast majority of men are going to need to marry. They need to become husbands and fathers in order to fully realize their manhood. So prepare yourself for those roles, for that kind of headship and leadership in your family. Prepare yourself to be a protector and provider. Of course, we need to get our kids out of the government schools. I probably don't have to tell this group that. We need to get our kids into masculine-friendly Christian schools or homeschool situations. We need to recover those male spaces that have been lost, places where younger men can be mentored and initiated into masculinity by older men. We need to train our sons for dominance. We need to train them with competence in mind so they can be protectors and providers. And we need a renewed vision for what manhood is. I love the way Rudyard Kipling sums up manhood in his poem, If. We've got this hanging on one of the stairways at our house. It's so good. I wanted my kids to see it every single day, because Kipling summarizes the kind of man we want our sons to be and the kind of men we want our daughters to marry. And I want to sum this up and wrap this up here by reading his poem, and I'll make a few little comments as we go, and then we'll take our break. This is what Kipling says in his poem, If. This is written for young men. He says, if you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, that is, if you can be calm, cool, and collected under pressure, if you can trust yourself when all men doubt you but make allowance for their doubting too, that is, if you can be confident, okay, that's what he's describing here is confidence, but a kind of humble confidence, if you can wait and not be tired by waiting or lied about, don't deal in lies. So if you can exercise patience and self-control and be so magnanimous that you can forgive those who sin against you, or being hated, don't give way to hating, and yet don't look too good nor talk too wise. That is, don't be vain, reject flattery, make an honest assessment of yourself. If you can dream and not make dreams your master, that is, have ambition, be visionary, but grounded in reality. If you can think and not make thoughts your aim, that is, don't get lost in fairy tale abstractions. Develop yourself intellectually, but for the sake of practicality, so it's not just an intellectual exercise. If you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two imposters just the same, that is, if you cannot be deterred by adversity, if you can keep your emotions in check, if you cannot be consumed by your own success, if you can bear to hear the truth you've spoken, twisted by knave to make a trap for fools, or watch the things you gave your life to broken and stoop and build them up with worn out tools. That is, if you have the grit and the toughness to build and then rebuild when necessary. If you can make one heap of all your winnings and risk it on one turn of pitch and toss, and lose and start again at your beginnings and never breathe a word about your loss. That is, if you can take risks, because risks are necessary to life, if you can invent and innovate and explore and build and do all those things, knowing how fragile all of that might be, but doing it anyway. If you can force your heart and nerve and sinew to serve your turn long after they are gone, and so hold on when there is nothing in you except the will which says to them, hold on. That is, if you have perseverance and resilience and self-discipline and courage and grit. If you can talk with crowds and keep your virtue, or walk with kings and not lose the common touch, if you have the social skills so you can get along in any different kind of situation, and you've got a kind of humble confidence that characterizes your life, if neither foes nor loving friends can hurt you, if all men count with you but none too much, that is, you love everybody and you seek to serve them all in ways that are appropriate, if you can fill the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run, that is, if you're hardworking and diligent, yours is the earth and everything that's in it, and which is more, you'll be a man, my son. That's Kipling, and I think he's exactly right, and that is exactly what we need. That poem is the antidote to the masculinity crisis. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, amen. Let's take our break.